My first guest today is Jill Stark. Jill is a journalist with the Sunday Age in Melbourne. She mostly covers health stories, alcohol, drug use issues, mental health, public policy, that kind of thing. She's won awards for some of the stories she's written over these things over the years. Like many, many journos, Jill enjoys a drink and all the fun and madness that comes from a big night out. Well, she used to anyway, because one morning Jill woke up with a hangover that was so evil and so frightening, it brought on an anxiety attack. And she began to wonder if she might be one of those binge drinkers she'd written about so often. And in deciding to go for a year without the bottle, Jill had to figure out just how deeply the business of drinking was embedded in being with other people, her social identity, and why people even wanted to be with her. Jill's book is called High Sobriety, My Year Without Booze. Hello, Jill.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Can we just get something clear at the outset? You see a big distinction between binge drinking and alcoholism. What's the big difference there to your mind?
Well, I mean, I would have said that before I wrote this book, but I think there are sort of quite a few shades of grey in between there. But yeah, I guess the classic binge drinker is someone who goes out at the weekend and drinks a lot, but perhaps doesn't drink much during the week, and that was certainly me. You know, alcoholic, we sort of think of the Hollywood style alcoholic as drinking wine for breakfast or whiskey in a brown paper bag and having the shakes and falling over. That certainly wasn't me. But
who craves it, who's addicted to it.
Who really needs it every day, and that certainly wasn't the situation that I was in. But socially, I'd become very dependent on it. So I think, having done a lot of research into it for the book, I think that my definition or my understanding of what dependency is slightly different from when I started.
I'm going to out myself here too, as someone who used to drink a lot when I was in my 20s, you know, because that was part of my social identity too, to go out and have fun. And I was a bit shy, and so it helped a lot. And I stopped drinking anywhere near as much as I did then. You know, when you have kids, that's a big, that's a thing that just makes it impossible, I think. So I think I can understand where you're coming from in all of this. Did you ever go through periods where you could actually go without alcohol? Did you try any period of abstinence before you decided to do the year-long thing?
Yeah, I did. So I did FebFast, which is where you give up alcohol for the month of February, which is the shortest month of the year. So that was a good start to give it a crack. I did it twice. It was an interesting experiment, but I found that because it was a short month, I just pretty much stayed at home for the whole of February and waited for it to be over.
Did you experience craving in that time for alcohol?
I mean, when I stopped for this whole year, I didn't, and both in those times with FebFast, I never had any withdrawal, if you like, or sense of I must have a drink. But socially and also emotionally, I think I really did crave it, because, you know, having a tough day at work, as you know, and the deadlines that we face in journalism and the stress of that, I often would crave a glass of wine when I came home. But I wasn't waking up in the morning thinking I must have a beer today or anything like that. But it's certain situations where alcohol would be something that I really missed in those periods of abstinence.
You grew up in Scotland, in Edinburgh. Can you remember the first time you got drunk?
Yes, I'd like to say very vividly, but it was a bit of a blur. But I do remember I was 13, and my best friend Fiona and I decided that we were going to get drunk. So we stole a can of lager from my parents' drinks cabinet, and we had sat it on the mantelpiece looking at it like some sort of holy grail that we were going to indulge in. And we had a pint glass, and we were going to pour it into this glass and pour sugar in it and drink it through a straw, because we heard that this would get us drunk faster and make it taste better. It was a very bad, cheap brand of lager. And so that was the plan. And we were sort of sitting, looking at it, waiting to have that first drink. And my older brother came home with one of his best mates. And he sort of looked at us. And it was a sort of the equivalent of, you know, Mick Dundee's "That's Not a Knife, This is a Knife" situation, where he just went, "What are you doing? You're not drinking that." And got into my parents' liquor cabinet and just started pulling out all these random spirits and pouring them into glasses and saying, "This is what you're going to drink." So he basically got us really quite plastered on these sort of little glasses of Mary Hell that he'd created. And yeah, that was my initiation into the world of booze.
Did you get into any, were there any mishaps that resulted from getting that drunk at that age? Did you hurt yourselves at all, or fall over, or what?
There was a lot of vomiting. There was a lot of, we went out, I think a bunch of friends and I think because girls could get away with sort of spraying their hair up really big and putting on a lot of makeup and going into pubs. We were in pubs when we were 14, and it's extraordinary that, I mean, we clearly looked like children with, you know, playing dress up, but we got into pubs and we quite regularly would get so drunk that one of us would pass out or would throw up. And you just think, I think back now and I think, God, if I ever have children, that would just horrify me to think that that's what's been going on. But yeah, my parents knew half of what I got up to, I think. But I think now that they've read the book, they know a bit more about it than perhaps they wanted to. But yeah, occasionally we would have parties when my parents left, and sometimes they'd come home early and we'd be tipping ashtrays into our pockets and hiding cans of beer down the back of the sofa and stuff. So it's a pretty interesting time growing up. But the thing being that that was just the norm where I grew up, and I think that it's probably not that different to Australia either.
You're keeping a diary at this time, weren't you? I'm just going to read out part of it here. This is something you wrote from the
time.
When
I was 16.
Yeah, when you were 16. I feel like I'm growing up too fast. I go out every weekend to pubs, get totally drunk. I have to stop drinking because, according to everyone, all guys identically, I am a much nicer person when I'm sober. But it's a vicious cycle. If I'm drunk, I talk to people and meet people with confidence in myself, and they tend not to like me. But if I stay sober, I don't talk to people or meet people because I'm too shy, and they won't be able to find out if I'm nice or not. It sounds like even at that age, you realise that alcohol could do stuff for you, but you knew that there was a price to be paid.
I actually found that diary when I went home during the year off the booze in 2011, and I was sifting through cardboard boxes in my mum's flat, and look, I find this diary, and this is halfway through my year off alcohol, and I was so shocked by that diary entry because I always just presumed that I didn't really have any insight into what alcohol did or didn't do for me, and it was only much later in life when I gave it a break that I started to have these insights. But reading that, I just thought, geez, I knew back then that this was not a great plan, and that really alcohol was being used as a social crutch, and I was using it to feel better about myself, but actually it wasn't giving me the results that I wanted. And yet, I looked at that entry, and as I said in the book, 20 years later, I was still using it for the same things I did when I was 16, and that was really confronting.
How typical was this behaviour for kids of your age around you?
Everyone was doing it. I mean, I think that's and again, in my current situation, I think everyone around me in my 30s was drinking in the same way. So it's very easy to sort of slip seamlessly into the social norm when everyone around you is doing it. Scotland, like Australia, is a country that sort of built its national identity on alcohol. So when you're 13 and 14 and having a drink, it's not really seen as that big a deal.
When you came to Australia and began to work at the as a journalist, how did you find Australia's drinking culture compared to Scotland's? You can see some similarities there. How similar was it?
Well, I think when I moved here, I sort of thought, this is great. You can drink at the football. You can get a day off to watch a horse race in the Melbourne Cup and get drunk. And it just seemed that this drive-through bottle shops, I'd never heard of such a thing. This was the place that invented the esky. It seemed like alcohol was very much a part of the national identity, and I really related to that, and I sort of thought this was my kind of country because that's where I'd come from. And I think it's very similar that we see ourselves in Australia as a sort of a nation of lovable larrikins and having a beer and sort of having a bit of fun is all part of that identity, very similar to Scotland. I sort of say in the book that if Scotland was a man, then he would be sort of knocking back single malts by an open fire, and if you Australian would be someone drinking beer at a backyard barbecue, it's essentially the same thing. Language barrier aside, I think those two men would be very good mates.
Being in Melbourne, I think, may well be significant too. I mean, Melbourne has got one of the great bar scenes in the world. It's one of those great bar cities. You can go from place to place to place. When I moved from Melbourne to Sydney years and years and years ago, I was really shocked by how little people drank because they went to get to bed early, to get up early in the morning so they could do their highly competitive job. Compared to Melbourne, there wasn't that kind of relaxing around a drink in a bar culture. Did you dive right into that in Melbourne?
I mean, I did, and I think that I love Melbourne's bar culture, and it's sort of a two-edged coin, though. It's sort of the sort of intimate nature of those little hole-in-the-wall bars and that real sophisticated European-style drinking culture that was deliberately set about to be created back in the 80s with deregulation. That's happened, and we have this vibrant bar scene, but what's happened with that deregulation is that there's been this proliferation of licenses. So you not only have that sort of quirky hole-in-the-wall cocktail bar, but you have these massive nightclubs, like booze barns that are open till 7 a.m. So you kind of have this clash of cultures that you can't put that genie back in the bottle once that deregulation has happened. And I think that's what Melbourne's struggling with at the moment, that it wants to be this sophisticated European-style city, but we're not drinking in the way that they do in the Mediterranean. We're drinking to get absolutely plastered every time we go out.
The whole time you're doing all this heavy journo drinking that's going on, what was the kind of social identity that developed around you and about you within the offices of The Age?
Well, I mean, it was very similar to when I started my career in Scotland. I worked in tabloids back in Scotland, and my nickname was Starkers. And then I came to Australia, and that's just the nickname that people coined here as well. And it's sort of Starkers the Party Girl was my my thing. And
Starkers the Party Girl.
Starkers the Party Girl. It's, on reflection, perhaps not the best name, but...
That doesn't sound as impressive as senior writer for The Age.
No, it doesn't.
Health issues.
Yeah,
yes.
That was my day persona. And at night, I was always the person. I was a sort of unofficial social secretary of the Sunday Age and The Age. And so when I did announce my plans to give up booze for a while, my editor sort of just looked at me with this look of, yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that's going to happen. She just was very... skeptical about if I would actually be able to finish that challenge, and I sort of describe it as akin to Hugh Hefner announcing plans to join the priesthood. People didn't think I was going to be able to pull it off.
Tell me about the Alcopop story that you wrote in 2008.
So Alcopops had been sort of demonised by people in the public health industry as the reason that young people were getting drunk and getting into all sorts of trouble, and at the end the alcohol industry had deliberately put this category of drinks onto the market to entice young people into drinking from an early age.
They're very sugary, and and all that sugar is kind of can disguise
how. And I actually did a story prior to this one that you're talking about in 2008, where an alcohol industry marketing person actually told me in a most extraordinary interview that this was actually on purpose, that the reason that these drinks were sugary and strong was that it was designed to mask the taste of alcohol for the unsophisticated palate. So previously, when we might be growing up, we would have to put sugar through in a glass and drink lager through a straw to make it more palatable. If you actually have a category of drinks that are already sweet and are to the taste of young people, then that gets them into drinking early. And this marketing insider actually admitted that this was a deliberate ploy by the industry to get young people to drink from an early age. So that was the environment that was
okay.
Around
so that's the story you're writing. What were the personal circumstances for you in which you actually wrote that story, though?
So the story that the government, the federal government, I got a call from a friend. It was midnight and I was very drunk at a dinner party with friends, and I had to work the next day. It was a Sunday the next day, and my friend from work said, the federal government have just announced that they're going to put the taxes up on Alcopops by 70%. This was a huge thing. This was a huge government instrument that they were cracking down hard on the industry. And I thought, okay, so I'm going to have to write that story tomorrow. And I got to bed about 2 and got...
You were hammered, yeah.
I was pretty drunk, and I got to work, and I had to write 1,500-word feature on what the ramifications were of this new tax. And so I had
to... still drunk or hungover at this point?
I still hungover, and I had
that
to,
awful point
it was
between
just that sort of very fuzzy, hazy. I'm having to write about a category of drinks that at that point made me gag just to think about. And I'm interviewing the federal health minister, Nicola Roxon, at the time. Luckily, it was on the phone, so she didn't have to see how hungover I was. But yeah, so I write this what turned out to be a fairly intelligent piece of writing, extraordinarily so. I don't know how I did it, but that, again, it took several years before I really kind of looked at that and went, okay, that sort of clash of my two worlds was quite interesting.
This story you wrote got an award. You actually got a journalism award for this, which you wrote about the pernicious effects of Alcopops. While that point between being hammered and hungover, did that thought creep into your mind that this isn't quite right?
Quite right, particularly when I was standing on the stage accepting that award, and then I went and got a bit drunk that night as well. And it took several years before I really hit the wall with that awful hangover in 2011. But I always sort of saw it as I was never writing opinion pieces saying that alcohol was bad. I was merely reporting the facts, and I sort of compared it to the public the transport reporter, like he shouldn't have to ride his bike to work to ease Melbourne's traffic congestion. I just didn't see, there was this real sort of cognitive dissonance between what I was doing and what I was writing about.
So Jill, when you did hit the wall in January 2011, what was that like to wake up that next day? What happened to you that morning when you woke up with that hangover?
Well, it wasn't in the morning. I think it was well after lunch before I even surfaced, because I didn't get home till about, I don't know, it was dawn. I think it was 6 a.m. or so. But it was just awful, and I'd been thinking about it for quite a while. There'd been 2 months of, that pre-Christmas kind of partying that just went on, and I just thought, I mean, physically I was just in a mess, but emotionally I was just all over the place, and I just thought, I can't continue to do this.
When you say emotionally, do you mean you had a kind of an anxiety?
I did. I sort of, and the irony being, of course, that I got a call from a friend that morning who was at work, who was wanting to meet, get some of my alcohol industry or alcohol public health expert contacts, because Brendan Favola, a Carlton footballer in Melbourne, had gone off the rails and was been arrested for being drunk, and there's me so hungover that I could barely give her the contact. But yeah, I was so unwell that I decided I was going to jump in my car and go to McDonald's to buy some food that would ease my pain, which turned out to be a bad idea. And I ended up having this panic attack where I had to pull the car over because I was not breathing properly. And that was a point where I just thought, what am I doing to myself that this is where I'm at?
So you got acquainted with the Hello Sunday Morning program, which is encouraging young people to just abstain. Mm. Abstain, and therefore greet Sunday morning with fresh eyes, hello world, yeah. that kind of thing. Having made that decision, you'd already had that period, as you said, where you'd abstained during February through FebFast. How was abstaining for a year, to your mind, going to be different from FebFast?
Well, I originally didn't plan to stop for a whole year, and Hello Sunday Morning is not an abstinence program as such. It's more, you know, taking a break rather than, like, they don't advocate that you should never drink again. It's nothing like that. But I had met Chris Rain, the founder of Hello Sunday Morning, a year before, and ever since I met him, I couldn't stop thinking about, I need to do this. And the difference between the month and what Hello Sunday Morning do is that it's a 3-month minimum. And I think that's the sort of minimum time you need to fundamentally change your relationship with alcohol, because in a month you can do what I did and just stay at home and white knuckle it and hope it's over. But in 3 months you can't. You have to go out and you have to do the things that you would normally have a drink in your hand to do. So I originally thought I'll do 3 months, and even that thought terrified me. And I think when the thought
terrifies
it,
you.
It really, yeah, did. And I think that was the point when I knew that I had to do it, because I thought, if this scares me so much, then why does it scare me so much that alcohol has become so much of a social crutch for me, that the thought of not having it in my life for 3 months is scary? Then that's a sign, I think, that you probably need to do it. So
the thought was terrifying.
Yeah.
And the terror was kind of scary.
Yeah. I mean, I never would have, if I'd thought I was going to do it for a year, I don't think I ever would have started. But I did 3 months. And then the great thing about Hello Sunday Morning is you write about it, you write a blog. I mean, I was 34 at the time. I didn't even know what a blog was. But basically you write about your experiences, and you put it on Facebook, or you share it with your friends. And that way you're accountable. And also, for the first time, I started to gain insights into why I was drinking. With FebFast, as great as it was to take a break, I didn't really document the journey, if you like. So I think that's what really made the difference.
So why were you drinking? Then you were going out and having fun, and still managing to have fun, which is nice. Still managing to dance, and dance successfully, which I'm not sure is entirely possible, but I'll take your word for it. It was for you. Maybe not for me, I don't know. But for you, it was indeed possible. What kind of things were you then starting to understand about how embedded alcohol was with who you thought you were and who your friends thought you were?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, because it was very much a part of my identity, being the party girl and being someone, you know, that always would be the first on the dance floor and the last to leave the party and that sort of thing. And then you take that away, and I did still go out and go to clubs and dance.
Because when you are that girl, people really light up when you walk into the room, don't they? They go, oh, she's here, now we're going to have fun.
They do, but I mean, there comes a point in the evening where you're just not being fun, you're just being stupid, and it's not that great when you're waking up at 6 or you're going home at 6 a.m. and you can't get out of bed.
So what's the difference when everyone knows you're abstaining, when walking into a room as stark as the party girl, as opposed to Jill, who's now abstaining from alcohol for a year? How are you visually greeted into that room when you walk into it?
Well, at first it was quite confronting, because a lot of people just couldn't handle it. They just were like putting pressure on me to drink, and I couldn't understand why I wasn't drinking. And it was like I'd broken some social contract between me and my friends, because we all drank in a very similar way, and when somebody opts out of that, it can be quite difficult for other people, which was something that really surprised me. But interestingly, on one night where I went to my favorite bar, a Cherry Bar in Melbourne, which is like a rock venue, and I was with a friend and we were just dancing and I was just going crazy and I was completely sober, and she turned to me and she said, you know, this is great, drunk Jill's just the same as sober Jill's just as much fun as drunk Jill. And I just thought that was such a great compliment, that often I didn't feel like I was having any less fun, but some people, it was more difficult for them, and once they got over it, that it was okay. But
so you weren't having less fun, but
No,
some
I mean,
of the people around you were having less fun.
Yeah, well, people just abstaining. Particularly, I mean, my friends got used to it fairly quickly, but at parties where strangers find out I wasn't drinking, there was this real sort of, you know, they were quite mistrusting of me or wondering why I wasn't drinking and saying, you know, thinking that I was religious or that I was somehow judging them. And I often thought that if I had a beer bottle in my hand and it was filled with water, it wouldn't matter, but it would just make them feel more comfortable. And I think that says a lot about our culture and the way the value that we place on alcohol, that people should be so uncomfortable if someone in the group's not drinking.
I had to abstain from drinking for 3 months once because I had glandular fever. Mm. And in the recovery period, you just got to, you know, mm. you risk hepatitis if you don't drink. And it was, I had to actually say, no, I'm sorry, I'm recovering from glandular fever and I have a risk of hepatitis. People to go, oh, all right. You know, that's what it took.
Yeah.
It's for people to be okay with me not drinking in their company.
Well, I came up with a list of excuses because it just got so tedious, people constantly asking me. So I'd say, you know, you could say you're pregnant, or you'd say, you know, I've just come out of rehab, or, you know, not drinking is one of my parole conditions. Like, those were the things that I started to come up with to just get through that awkward moment when people really kind of force a drink on you.
Did friends or people you knew anyway, because you were a part of a book club,
mm.
and when you showed up and you didn't have that glass of wine, was that seen as a kind of reproach? Were you seeing this being a bit holier than thou?
Yeah, there was an issue there where some of my girlfriends were quite concerned that I was making some moral judgment on them, and it led to quite an interesting conversation because our book clubs had always been boozy, and you know, that was sort of part of the fun of it all, and we'd talk about the book for half an hour and then we'd just drink lots of wine. And so when I wasn't doing that, it was difficult for some of them. And when I talked about it, and I made them understand that, because one of the girls said to me, well, what you're saying is that we all drink in the same way, and now you're not drinking like that, and you're saying that what we do is bad. And I said, no, what I'm saying is that the way that I was drinking for me was starting to have consequences, where I was having a panic attack and have to pull the car over to the side of the road. And really, the value of that was too big a price to pay. So if you continue to drink like that and you don't have those consequences, then good luck to you. And I don't have a problem with that. So when I explained to them it was a very personal choice, I think that made things a bit easier. But certainly there was a sense that I'd kind of, like I said, broken this social contract that we all drink in the same way, and suddenly I'm opting out of it. So it's as if I'm judging people, which was something I tried really hard not to do because I was aware that that was an issue.
You were a single girl at the time.
Yep.
Was it much harder to flirt? It had to be harder, surely.
It definitely was. Although I did, like, you know, about a month into it, I did actually meet somebody at a club that same when I was dancing and you know, carrying on as if I was drunk, because people don't really notice if you are or not, because they're all too blind to notice. Yeah, right. So it's quite liberating. You can do whatever you like. But I did meet someone in that time and had a bit of a passion. That was kind of, you know, probably the first sober kiss I'd had in many, many years. But
was it all the better or worse for that?
It was actually quite good. Yeah, it was sort of, you're a bit self-conscious when you're sort of kissing someone on a dance floor and you're completely sober. But yeah, it was interesting. But I think that when I met guys sober, what was really instructive was how some of them really recoiled in horror at the fact that I wasn't drinking. Like, and that really pointed out to me how perhaps previously I was attracted to the wrong type of men. So being sober, it's like, okay, if that guy needs me to be drunk to even chat me up, then maybe that's not the guy for me.
The beer goggles are off, guys. The beer goggles are off. Be warned. Truly, is there such a thing as beer goggles, do you think?
Oh, yes. I did some research into that, and there's a definite bow to wow factor when it comes to drinking. So when you take that away, you do tend to make more discerning choices.
And when your year was up, having a drink again, has it changed the way you drink now?
Oh, definitely. I mean, and that's not to say that I don't still have big nights out. I have been drunk again, and I don't live like a nun. I just, I probably have far more occasions socially where I choose not to drink because just choose to have one. And I think that's because I've gone through that period of knowing that I can function socially without it. So if I don't feel like drinking, then I won't. And I'd never use alcohol as an emotional crutch, so I don't drink. I don't very rarely drink at home or because I'm stressed.
Are you really stronger for having that year of abstinence?
Absolutely. Like, it's amazing what inner resilience you can tap into when you realize that you don't need alcohol for all the social situations that you think you did. And going through a lot of stress during the year without alcohol and realizing that you can actually get through that and not have to reach for a glass of wine to take the edge off, it really does teach you a lot about yourself.
as your drinking ramped down a bit, are you drinking? I mean, are you still going and having fun? I understand all that, but by and large, are you having fewer drinks over the course of a week?
Yes, definitely.
As a result,
yeah.
And are you less troubled by, you know, those things that were niggling away with, oh, I need drink to be entertaining, I need a drink to be this kind of person that makes people like me?
Yeah, definitely. It's just sort of something that I don't think about so much anymore, and I really, I'm quite confident going into any social situation now because I've done it for a whole year without alcohol, and you meeting strangers, going to weddings, having birthdays, you know, completely sober. It just teaches you a lot about yourself, so I'm much more confident than I was back then.
So their world. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.